we are very close to the feast, and it is time that we make sure that we are ready physically and spiritually. But we know that before the Feast of Tabernacles, we have the Day of Atonement, next Sabbath. And our guest speaker is going to be here, so we're happy about that. And I want to take some time today to discuss an aspect of the Feast of Atonement, that holy day. And I'm going to start off in the book of Jonah, so if you would turn there to chapter 3. Because if you look at various places in the Bible where nations have called fasts, a nationwide fast, there's, of course, the interesting situation in the book of Jonah. Now, there are several times in the nation of Israel, the physical nation of Israel or Judah, that fasts were called. If you had to think of a time, one of the first that might come to mind is from the book of Esther, when it was asked that everyone fast for 3 days and three nights. There were times where various armies were surrounding Israel or Judah. Jehoshaphat at one time called a nationwide fast. And in these situations, we recognize that if they fasted for the right reasons, with the right attitudes, that God responded. And in the book of Jonah, we find the prophet Jonah, who was very much a fan of Israel. He was sent to Israel, and as a prophet, his responsibility was to encourage the people. That's what he did as a prophet. It's kind of like all of a sudden a Ravens fan was told to go cheer for the Broncos, because he's told now to go preach to Nineveh, and that if Nineveh repents, that God would spare them. And that really bothered him, because as someone who loved Israel, Assyria was very much against Israel and caused Israel all kinds of difficulties. And so he recognized that Assyria and Nineveh were on the way down in history, and that he was fine with that, because we know that God made it very clear to him what he wanted to do. And Jonah, of course, at first refused to do it. And then when he did do it, he did it with a bad attitude afterwards, where God had to work with him in that regard. But what we find is that when Jonah went to Nineveh, he goes to preach to Nineveh. In verse 2, it says, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and preach to it the message that I tell you." So Jonah arose and went to Nineveh according to the word of the Lord. Now Nineveh was an exceedingly great city, a 3-day journey in extent. At the time, based upon history, it was considered the largest city in the world. So this is where Jonah was sent to preach. So he arose, he went to Nineveh. So in verse 4 it says, "And Jonah began to enter the city on the first day's walk, and then he cried out and said, 'Yet 40 days and Nineveh shall be overthrown.'" So when we had the Bible Bowl last week in Bedford, we told the, after a while, we just told them, if the answer involves a number, choose 40 or 70. Or 7, I mean, 40 or 70. 7. And one of those two are almost always right. And here's, of course, 40 days. So if the question ever comes up, how long did he cry out in Nineveh? It was 40 days. And he said, 40 days and Nineveh shall be overthrown. So the people of Nineveh believed God and proclaimed a fast. And they put on sackcloth from the greatest to the least of them. Then the word came to the king of Nineveh in verse 6. And he arose from his throne and laid aside his robe. And he did the same. And he caused it, in verse 7, to be proclaimed and published throughout Nineveh by the decree of the king and his nobles, saying, "Let neither man nor beast, herd nor flock taste anything. Do not let them eat or drink." And so they declared a national fast. And we see in verse 9, it says, "Who can tell if God will turn and relent?" So they believed Jonah, what he was saying. They called a national fast to the extent that even the animals weren't fed. Even the animals were without food. And if they truly fasted, then they would have been without water as well. And we know that God did relent. Verse 10, it says, "Then God saw their works, that they turned from their evil ways, and God relented from the disaster that He had said that He would bring upon them, and He did not do it." So God saw the works that they turned from their evil way, and He relented from the disaster that He was going to bring upon Nineveh at that time. So we're going to draw a correlation here as to why God has us fast on atonement. In relation to His master plan for all of humanity, why on this holy day, right before the Feast of Tabernacles? Let's review Leviticus 23, one of the chapters mentioned in Mr. Thompson's article of the Day of Atonement. Leviticus chapter 23, starting in verse 26. Leviticus 23, verse 26 says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Also the tenth day of the seventh month shall be the day of atonement. It shall be a holy convocation." So it happens to fall on a weekly Sabbath next week, but the day is a holy day. It's a holy convocation when we come together. "And you shall afflict your souls and offer an offering made by fire to the Lord. And you shall do no work on the same day, for it is the day of atonement." So anytime there's holy days, holy times, we don't work, we know that. And on this particular one, we're told to afflict ourselves. "For any person who is not afflicted of soul on that same day, he shall be cut off from his people." So I can just picture this next Saturday. If somebody comes walking in with a dozen donuts, we're going to cut them off at the door. Don't let them in. So it says if you're not properly afflicted, then you shouldn't even be among the people. "And any person who does any work on that same day, that person I will destroy from among his people." Verse 31, "You shall do no manner of work. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. It shall be to you a Sabbath of solemn rest. And you shall afflict your souls on the ninth day of the month at evening. From evening to evening you shall celebrate your Sabbath." So we see the Day of Atonement is a day from evening to evening, sunset to sunset, and we are told to afflict our souls. And if you read about what it means to afflict, afflicting a soul, the soul is one of those Bible terms that seems to throw some people off. We understand that we are souls because we are living, breathing beings. We're alive. We have life, so we can be considered a soul. So it just means we are afflicting ourselves. And the term for affliction, it does mean to fast. It means to fast without food and without water. So if that's something that you haven't studied before, it makes a good Bible study. So we afflict our soul. We go without food and without water on this day, this holy day. So it's important to recognize, as it states in Isaiah, that sin cuts humanity off from God. God will not dwell with sin. And so we understand that through Passover and the blood of Jesus Christ, the first fruits are reconciled with God. But the Day of Atonement points forward. It points to the future. We understand that at that time, that Satan will be bound and put away. And every human being will have the opportunity to be reconciled with God. So all of humanity will have the opportunity to humble themselves before God. We covered on trumpets the fact that humanity refuses to humble itself before God. And that's why God does what He will do, or will do what He says He will do, in the prophecies about the end time, the day of trumpets, when it's fulfilled. And when they go to war, humanity goes to war against God will put them down. And we will fight with him because humanity will not humble themselves. God will humble them. So after humanity has been humbled, God will remove the primary cause for sin. So Satan and the demons will be gone, and all humanity will have the opportunity to be reconciled and to have a relationship with God, with the Creator. But it's important that we humble ourselves now. As the nation of Israel, the spiritual nation of Israel, God calls a national fast for all of His people on this Day of Atonement. And it is a time, through the fast, even as Nineveh did and other examples that you can see of national fast, that they humble themselves before God and they strive to recognize what it is that God wants them to do. Let's turn to 1 Timothy chapter 3. There's a point here I want to make in 1 Timothy chapter 3. So remember, the Feast of Tabernacles pictures time of God's kingdom upon this earth. 1 Timothy chapter 3, it's talking about the qualification of first an elder and then a deacon. Verse 1, it says, "This is a faithful saying, if a man desires the position of a bishop," which literally means overseer. We use the term elder. It can be translated any of those terms. "He desires a good work." So it's not saying if you desire the office because you want the title or the office, you can ask Mr. Jackson, it doesn't pay much if that's why you desire it. It demands a lot, doesn't pay much, except in the kingdom. I got to get that in there. Don't forget that. The reward's in the kingdom. It's talking about if you desire to truly serve, that's a good thing. If you really desire to serve God and to serve His people, that's appropriate, and it's a good thing for a man to do that. So if that's a desire that you have in that sense, in that work, then it's a good thing. Then it goes through the qualifications. But it gets down to verse 6, as far as someone not to ordain. "Do not ordain a novice," is the way that it's worded in the New King James, "lest being puffed up with pride, he fall into the same condemnation as the devil." So the Apostle Paul was inspired to write this because he certainly recognized, through God's inspiration especially, the aspect of human nature, the proclivity of human nature to think more highly of itself than it should. And that there are some people who put into any position, it doesn't matter if it's setting up chairs or speaking or whatever it might be, if they're given a title or an office, then they immediately start to try to exalt themselves above other human beings. It's a proclivity of human nature. So it says, don't do this with a novice, lest you just put them at danger. And I've seen over the years, almost any time someone's ordained, and it doesn't matter if they're ordained a deacon or an elder, then Satan will attack them. It's almost as if God is going to use them in this area to serve in a greater way, and Satan decides that he is going to test them and attack them. You can ask Mr. Jackson if he believes that's true, but I've seen it happen more than once over the years. So we want to make sure that whoever's ordained is somebody that's strong. The word for novice, it actually means a newly planted, like newly planted grass or a newly planted tree. What do you call that? A sapling. Word wouldn't come to my mind. So like a newly planted sapling is what it's referring to. So if a tree has just been planted, even Brianna could walk over and pull it out of the ground. And because its roots its roots haven't gone down into the ground to where it's strong. And so when it says not a novice, it means someone that's new to the faith, to where they haven't been rooted in the truth for a long period of time, to where they've been tested, and you know that they're faithful. Or even someone, if they've been around, but their roots just haven't grown strong, then you don't want to ordain that person because the tendency is it'd be easy for them to be puffed up with pride. And they could fall into the same condemnation as the devil, as it's put. And we understand that the devil's problem, Satan's problem, was that he had a matter of pride. And he allowed his pride to lift himself up in his own mind. So that's the correlation that's being brought on here by Paul in regards to ordaining a novice and the condemnation of Satan. Let's review in Isaiah 14. I think everybody, most of us will, if you're asked where does it talk about the fall of Lucifer, you can remember Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. So Satan was so puffed up with pride that he was blinded to himself. Verse 12 says, "How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. For you have said in your heart..." So we understand that whenever the Bible talks about somebody saying something in their heart, it's their reasoning process. So they've gone through their thought process or their thinking, their reasoning process, and they've come to a conclusion. That's the point that's being made here. And we understand from Scripture that sin starts in the mind. And that's why we emphasize that the battle is for our mind, our attitudes, and what we dwell on and think and what we allow to be put into our minds. Because once it's there, it's there. It's in the subconscious, even if you're not thinking about it. It's there. And so he's gone through this reasoning process, and he comes to the conclusion that he will ascend into heaven. He says, "I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation, on the furthest or farthest sides of the north." So God's throne is in the north, the highest of heavens, and Satan is saying that he's going to ascend even above that. And he will be like the Most High, or will ascend above the heights of the clouds. So part of reasoning or speculation is that Satan was put on the earth to tend or prepare the earth. Some people will speculate that he knew some aspects of God's plan, that humans would be created and eventually be above the angels or whatever it might be. And he's thinking, wait a minute, I'm created perfectly and I'm going to exalt myself. So he's making all of these claims. And let's go to Ezekiel 28 and add a little bit more to this. Ezekiel chapter 28. So we understand in this chapter that the king of Tyre blends into a type of Lucifer. Verse 2, it says, "Son of man, say to the prince of Tyre, thus says the Lord God, because your heart is lifted up," and lifted up means full of pride, "because your heart is lifted up and you say, I am God." So here was a man that was thinking that he was God. There's multiple examples of that. Human beings get so full of themselves, they decide that they're God. The king of Tyre did it. We believe Nimrod did it. We believe Nebuchadnezzar did it. We have from history, the Roman emperors did it. They set themselves up as deities. Human beings become so full of themselves. This is that proclivity that was talking about in Timothy. Now, I never saw this, but I used to hear about the deacons that thought that they were Gestapo police or something of that nature, and made people sit down, and if you were a teenager and you passed a note in church, they would come and take it from you, and if you liked the ravens, they would take your jerseys and throw them on the bonfires. And all these things that they would do. Not that the deacons thought that they were God, but they certainly thought that they were something because of their office. But human beings get to the point, they become so full of themselves, as it says, that your heart is lifted up, and he's putting himself in the place of God, so that he doesn't believe he needs God. It says, yet you are a man, not a God, though you set your heart as the heart of a God. And then verse 3, behold, you are wiser than Daniel. There's no secret that can be hidden from you. So from what we understand, the king of Tyre was a very intelligent and smart man. And it goes on to talk about that he became very great and powerful and rich. And then we come to verse 12, where it says, son of man, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre and say to him, thus says the Lord God, you were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. So we understand now it's gone from not talking about a human, it's talking about Lucifer before he rebelled. Verse 13, you were in Eden, the garden of God, and every precious stone was your covering. And it goes through the various stones. And then it says, the workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day you were created. So apparently he was very musical and could sing. Verse 14, you were the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you. And then by the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence within, and you sinned. Therefore, I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroy you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones. Verse 17, your heart was lifted up, so full of pride. Because of your beauty, you corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. I laid you before kings that they might gaze at you. And so we recognize that, again, he reasoned within his mind that he was so wonderful and so great, and that he should be upon the highest of thrones, and that he should be above God. So he corrupted his own character with these thoughts and with these attitudes, and he manipulates human nature, that humans have this proclivity. Let's turn back to Ephesians chapter 2. We know from these scriptures that all of us at one time walked or lived according to the ways of the world. Verse 1, it says, in you he made alive. So remember, there's only two ways of life, the narrow, straight path that leads to life and the broad way that leads to death. So you he made alive who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked according to the course of this world. So the course means the way or the path of this world. And so we once walked according to the way of the world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. And so it goes on to talk about how we also once conducted ourselves based upon this inspiration. So there is the influence of Satan on human nature, on attitudes, on our reasonings, on what goes on in our thoughts and our minds. And it demonstrates itself in various ways, in various people. So it's not all that every one of us get to where we just puff ourselves up and are full of pride, as it talks about. There's various ways that it happens, but that pride thing is just very strong in human beings. In 1 John, it talks about the pride of life, and that it will be destroyed. that pride of life, of thinking that we're so great. So human beings today, a majority of them, believe they do not need God. And then we can go into another percentage who believe that there is no God. Not only do we not need God, but there is no God. There is no life giver. There is no creator. And if you believe in that, what are you thinking? You know, it's considered in some circles to be foolishness to believe in God. So there is a pride of life. And that pride of life that's talked about in 1 John, it's talking about vainglory or an insolent assurance which trusts in its own power and resources. So it's talking about someone who begins to trust in themselves, their own reasoning, their own wisdom, their own ability to accomplish and to do things. And human beings can do incredible things. So it doesn't matter who we are or how we are, we have to recognize this and we have to guard against it. We have to be aware of it. Because human beings trust on themselves. The way I've put it in the past is that the majority of us, if we're not careful, we can bow down at the altar of our own opinions and our own thoughts and our own reasonings, what goes on within our minds, so that we come out with outputs that don't match what we believe and what we want to do. So we have to be aware of this, and we have to make sure that we humble ourselves before God. So spiritual Israel is responsible for staying humble before God today. Now, the rest of humanity will be humbled before God when Christ returns, right before Christ returns during the day of the Lord, and then when Christ returns. But we must humble ourselves before God now. And we recognize that atonement, it points to the time when all of humanity will be reconciled with God. But we have that responsibility of making sure that we are reconciled with God now. And so again, why do we fast on the Day of Atonement? Let's go to Isaiah 58 and review the section of Scriptures that talks specifically about fasting. Isaiah 58. So we have a chapter in the Bible that points out the wrong way and reasons, wrong reasons for fasting, and the right way. Verse 2, it says, "Yet they seek me daily and delight to know my ways, as a nation that did righteousness and did not forsake the ordinance of their God. They ask of me the ordinance of justice and take delight in approaching God." And then verse 3, it says, "Why have we fasted, they say, and you have not seen? Why have we afflicted our souls and you take no notice? In fact, in the day of your fast you find pleasure and exploit your laborers." Some commentaries will say that the day of your fast is specifically talking about atonement. I don't know if it is or not. But as a nation, they observed atonement. And so they, even though they would go to the temple and things on atonement, if they had slaves or people that worked for them, they would make them work. And that was the mindset of the people at the time. It says, in fact, you find pleasure on the day. You exploit your laborers. And then it goes on to say in verse 4, "Indeed, you fast for strife and debate, and to strike with the fist of wickedness. You will not fast as you do this day to make your voice heard on high." So he goes on to say, is that the way, is that a fast that I have chosen? A day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head like a bull rush and to spread out sackcloth and ashes? Would you call this a fast and an acceptable day to the Lord? And so it goes through various aspects of wrong attitudes or wrong reasons for fasting. Fasting for the wrong reasons and in the wrong ways, and even with the concept of what God gets out of a fast. So we see that it's not to make our voice heard on high. And I don't know that anybody here, I'm not trying to say that any of us have this idea or this understanding about it, but I have talked to people before, and they say, I don't understand why this is still going on. I fasted about it, and God hasn't answered my prayer or whatever it might be, however they word it, but I fasted about it. And God's saying, you don't fast to make, none of us do, we don't fast to make our voice heard on high. Even the article that I read from Mr. Thompson when he said, take a day to fast, he said it's to draw closer to God. Anytime we fast, whether it's on Atonement or any other day of the year, the focus should be on drawing closer to God. Now, when's the best time to draw closer to God? Because I've also had people say, well, then why do we fast if we're going through a trial? Well, if life is difficult, if there are problems, if you have to make major decisions, it's a good time to be close to God. It's a good time to be in tune to God and His wavelength and His way of thinking. It's a good time to be studying the Scriptures, fasting and praying and studying. Now, so it's always the purpose is to draw closer to God. Now, that's the first purpose, but then we come to verse 6, and God says, now here's why I want you to fast. Is this not the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke. So he says it's to loose the bonds of wickedness. If we're drawing close to God, you remember Nineveh as a nation, they fasted and they said, whoa, wait a minute, he's going to wipe us out if we don't change our ways, if we don't do this differently. Now that's what they recognized was necessary, that they needed to humble themselves before God, to loose the bonds of wickedness. And sin is a heavy burden. And it literally, even when it says heavy burdens, it's talking about the bonds of the yoke. And since I know that you remember all of my sermons, you probably remember the sermon I gave that talked about putting a yoke, that they used to put yokes on people, heavy wooden yokes to make them stand in line and go where they wanted them to go, when they wanted them to go there, and do what they wanted them to do. I mean, it's a burden. It's heavy, and it hurts, and it's hard. And so that's what that's referring to. And sin can become that way. Anything that we put before God can become that way. So when we have burdens, difficulties in life, or trials, or whatever it might be, that's the perfect time to fast and to draw near to God. Before the Feast of Tabernacles, it's important that we humble ourselves and draw near to God, that we are reconciled with God. Verse 7, is it not to share your bread with the hungry? So keep that in mind as we fast before the Feast of Tabernacles. One aspect of it is that it should put us in a mind frame of being willing to share what we have. And what a perfect time at the Feast of Tabernacles. What a perfect time to ask someone out to eat. And maybe not your best friends, maybe someone that you recognize that could use a meal. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, and that you bring your house to your house, the poor who are cast out? When you see the naked, that you cover him and hide, and not hide yourself from your own flesh. And so it goes through the right mindset and the right attitude and the right reasons for fasting, and for fasting in the right way. And because as it talks about, and Nineveh did this as well, this was the custom of the day. Even during the days of Jesus Christ, if somebody fasted, I've already thought this through. I thought if we did that on the Day of Atonement, I'd go to Goodwill, buy a $5 suit, and then come in here and rip it. I'm not going to rip one of my good ones, so. But we don't do that. But that was their custom. But they wanted people to know that they were fasting. So they threw ashes on their heads. They shaved their heads. And they wore this clothing that people knew that they were afflicted in that sense. And of course, that's not what we are to do. In Matthew 6, it talks about when you fast, you wash your face, you come to atonement, you wear your Sabbath wear, as is appropriate. So we recognize that. We don't fast for a show. Fasting is something that's very personal between us and God. And if we're doing it for the right reasons, it will, every one of us, it will draw us closer to God. And so we humble ourselves before God. God doesn't take any pleasure out of us being hungry. I know some of you don't get hungry during a fast. I talk to some people and they make it seem easy. I get hungry. I feel it after, it doesn't take that long, I guess, after breakfast. I start to know I'm fasting. I don't drink coffee very much at all. I did this morning, but usually I don't. But I used to get the caffeine headaches occasionally when I'd fast. And I'm hoping this year, since I've been drinking tea or nothing for that matter, other than water in the mornings, maybe it won't be an issue. But the point is that we are to fast for the right reasons, and we are to fast in the right way, and we are to fast and recognize that fasting is for us. It's not for God. Fasting is for us to draw closer to God, to humble ourselves before God, and to strive to see our weaknesses or where we fall short of God's glory, so that we can unloose the bonds of wickedness. If you study in the Proverbs, it talks about the cords of sin, because sometimes we get in such a way of life that it's as if it's got us bound or tied up. And that's what it's talking about as far as loosening that grip that sometimes wrong thinking or wrong attitudes have on our minds and in our lives. And so fasting for the right way, or in the right way and for the right reasons, helps us to loosen that. So fasting should produce change. It should produce change. And fasting on atonement, if we do it in the right attitude with the right reasons, if we're not just concerned about what we're going to eat after atonement, if we're not just concerned about getting through it, then it puts us in the right frame of mind as we head to the Feast of Tabernacles, to where we want to serve and we want to give. So fasting is one of the best ways to maintain humility and to stay close to God. That's true as a congregation or an organization or an individual, as Christians. It's true for each and every one of us. Fasting is one of the best ways to maintain humility and to keep us relying on God. And godly humility is a key to serving, to God being able to use us as servants, and God being able to use us during the feast. So why do we fast on atonement? It's to help us to humble ourselves so that we don't think too highly of ourselves, and we're willing to serve others. We're willing to go to the feast in the right frame of mind so that we can be spiritually fed and so that we can be used by God to serve. So we know that Jesus Christ set the perfect example of service for us. Every one of us know that. Jesus Christ set that example. And as future kings and priests, our responsibility is to humble ourselves before God, to go into the Feast of Tabernacles in the right frame of mind. And if we do that, it can be the best feast ever.